Today is November 28th, 2017, and it was 126 years ago today when the IBEW was founded in the humble boarding house, which is now the Henry Miller Museum in the city of St. Louis. And joining us on this special day from the International Office in Washington, D.C., is IBEW Museum Curator Curtis Bateman. Curtis, thanks for joining us.
No problem, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, when the museum project kicked off in 2015, we turned to you to verify a lot of our early history. And one of the documents you provided us is considered to be one of the most accurate accounts of our early history.
Yes, and that document is a brief history of the IBEW written by our first Secretary Treasurer, J.T. Kelly. He put pen to paper for the 16th convention that was held in 1921. And because he was one of the remaining, you know, founders of the organization, he had never really come across a detailed history of our founding and was asked by, you know, several, you know, dozen members to put his thoughts to paper. And so he finally did this and gave us a wonderful brief history lesson of the founding of the organization and put it in the program for that year's convention. And this was really a treasure trove of information regarding our early days, and it still provides insight today.
Well, that's pretty exciting. This document was not widely circulated. I didn't know anything about it until you sent it from your office in D.C. Was this ever published other than distributed during the 1921 convention?
I guess in its totality, it was never republished. Snippets of it can be found in other convention proceedings, or occasionally, you know, for the IBEW's 50th anniversary, which was in, I guess, 1941, and the 75th anniversary, you know, there was an anniversary article in the IBEW Journal, or, you know, other sources like that, that would kind of use quotes taken from this intro here and there. But it was never really published in its totality since it first appeared in 1921, which I guess is a shame, but it's probably it goes to the problem, you know, we've had in documenting history, where some records get lost if they're not republished over and over again, and that's sort of something that we're trying to change, you know, today with the IBEW Museum in D.C. and with the Henry Miller Museum. You know, a lot of these documents are being brought to light for the first time and being properly preserved for future generations.
And we're going to come back to that later on, as you will see, but we have something very special in store for the members on this episode, because that document is the focus of this episode. We reached out to J.T. Kelly's family, and they have agreed to narrate sections of that original document, our original history, as written by their ancestor. And so that's what we're going to hear next. We've got 13 members of the Kelly family. We've got some up in California on the coast, and we even have a couple in Australia. So we're going to talk about that, and it is my great honor to introduce the members of the IBEW to the Kelly family, and we're going to start off with Lucas James Kelly, the great-great-grandson of J.T. Kelly, and we'll listen to this, and then Curtis and I will talk about it here in a minute. This is about 3 minutes and 22 seconds.
Excellent.
My name is Lucas James Kelly. I'm the great-great-grandson of J.T. Kelly. My father is James William Kelly III. My grandfather is James William Kelly Jr. And my great-grandfather is James William Kelly Sr., who is the son of J.T. Kelly. A brief history of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, as written by J.T. Kelly in 1921. The International Brotherhood was organized in St. Louis in November 1891, nearly a third of a century ago, and as very few of the present membership, and probably none of the delegates to the 16th Convention, remember or know the origin and early history of the organization, the Arrangement Committee representing the St. Louis unions has requested me, as one of the organizers and first Grand Secretary, to prepare a brief history of the Brotherhood. In 1890, the St. Louis Exposition decided to make electricity the leading feature and employed a number of electrical workers to wire the booths, displays, and decorations. While doing this work, the question of organizing a union was discussed and finally led to calling a meeting at Stoll Hall near the Biddle Market. The organizer of the AF of L, Mr. Charles Castle, was called in, and he arranged for a charter and completed the organization. Our charter was received, and we became Wiremen's and Linemen's Union No. 5221, AF of L, with the following officers: John Pearson, President; Frank Lockman, Vice President; Fred Shantz, Recording Secretary; and James Ross, Financial Secretary. At the next election, in January, Henry Miller was elected President and J.T. Kelly, Vice President. Henry Miller was a tireless worker and would tell us at each meeting that unless there was a national organization of electrical workers, we could never hope to accomplish much, and any advantage gained by an isolated union could not be permanent, while the great masses of electrical workers were unorganized, that the argument that individuals should join a union of their craft and all act as a unit applied with equal force to unions, therefore, a national or international organization of a craft was an absolute necessity. At Brother Miller's suggestion, a committee was elected early in 1891 to agitate the question of a national organization. The committee consisted of Henry Miller, William Matine, Joseph Berlevitz, Dave Guinea, William Hedden, James Dorsey, and J.T. Kelly, secretary. The committee prepared a circular which was mailed to electrical workers in every city in the country. Brother Matine, the wandering Jew, furnished the greater part of the addresses to which circulars were sent. Other members of the committee had also floated a little, and with information received from other members of the union, the committee was soon in communication with all the principal cities.
So that was Lucas James Kelly with the first page of A Brief History of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. And Curtis, a couple of things that kind of struck me in this segment is, number one, Henry Miller was not the first president of Local 5221.
Correct. I know, it's kind of a shock. Mr. Pearson was the president at the time. But, you know, I mean, Henry Miller, I guess, got his footing in unionism with Local 5221 and probably learned from Mr. Pearson, learned from the other officers, and finally went out on his own riding the rails to see if he could expand upon 5221 and make a national organization. But I think the other big kind of shock, I think, to many members is this mention of Stoley's Hall and near Biddle Market being the home of 5221. I think for many decades, Stoley's Hall has been the assumed founding place for the IBW. But it turns out that it was actually the place where 5221 met. And I think that still comes as a surprise to many, many members.
Starting on the 21st of this past week on the museum's Facebook page and the Twitter account, we've been publishing some snippets from newspapers, newspaper reports from the time, talking about Lightstone's Hall.
Yes.
And 36 or 50 or 100 delegates, which we know wasn't true.
Mm-hmm. And I think actually J.T. Kelly either mentions this later on in this history that we are hearing narrated, but yeah, in an attempt to make the founding convention seem much more prominent and dignified, our early founders released some propaganda articles to city newspapers saying that there were hundreds of delegates, that it was held at a big grand ball at Lightstone's, to make it sound like this was a huge event, and it certainly was in our history, but it wasn't gonna, you know, there wasn't the actual amount of people in the city to organize this event. So to make it sound more, you know, ostentatious and grand, they had these little differing accounts of the founding, and I think that's led to a lot of the confusion we have today. But hopefully, with the Henry Miller Museum and what the work we do in the International, we are actually clearing a lot of that up. But this document that we're reading today has helped clear the waters on that front.
And you can be sure that JT is smiling down on us now as we hear this next portion from JC Kelly.
This is JC Kelly. I am the great-great-granddaughter of JT Kelly. My father is James William Kelly III, my grandfather is James William Kelly Jr., and my great-grandfather is James William Kelly Sr., who is the son of JT Kelly. The results did not satisfy Brother Miller, and he decided to take a trip at his own expense. He visited Evansville, Louisville, Indianapolis, Chicago, and Milwaukee, and organized a union in each city. Unions were also organized in Toledo, New Orleans, Pittsburgh, Cincinnati, Philadelphia, and Duluth. There were also a union of wiremen in New York, and the United Order of Linemen had a few lodges on the Pacific Coast. The latter organization, being composed entirely of linemen, organized on the principle of secret societies and not affiliated with other labor organizations, did not last long. In September 1891, the St. Louis Union issued a call for a convention to meet in that city on November 21st. Chicago sent T.J. Fennell, Toledo, F.J. Heiselman, Indianapolis, E.C. Hartung, and Evansville, Harry Fisher. St. Louis was represented by Henry Miller, J.T. Kelly, and William Hedden. Three other unions requested members of the St. Louis Union to represent them by proxy, and C.J. Sutter, Joseph Berlovitz, and James Dorsey were added to the list of delegates, making 10 in all, as shown in the accompanying group photograph. Some of these delegates have continued active members to the present. Some have answered to the final roll call. Some have gone into business. Some have fallen by the wayside.
So some answered the final roll call.
Mm-hmm. Meaning they have passed away, right? So, and again, you know, this history article was written, you know, 30 years after that founding convention. So if you assume that most of the gentlemen were in their 20s and 30s at the convention, then, you know, some of them might be in their 50s or even 60s, and, you know, could either have, you know, passed away on the job or passed away of old age. But it is, it does kind of drive home how few founders were left, and how important it was for Kelly to actually give us this history. But I think that first paragraph really, I mean, it summarizes Miller's year-long journey. But if you could just imagine, he's visiting, you know, dozens of towns, perhaps for the first time on his own dime, trying to unionize electrical workers. You know, this is, for many of these men, this was the first experience they've ever had with a union, and a lot of cities didn't look too favorably upon Miller's efforts. So he was driven out of a few places, you know, very publicly. So a lot of his meetings were done, you know, in secret or in code. I mean, it was a very desperate time to actually get a sort of movement growing, just simply by word of mouth. But we owe a lot to you know, to his efforts through his own, you know, blood, sweat, and tears.
And so I think it's important to point out here that after 5221 is formed, I mean, he leaves St. Mm-hmm. Louis.
He does. Yeah. He says, I got a greater calling here.
And comes back, as we'll see later. Mm-hmm. But that's a lot of travel for someone mm-hmm. in 1891 who was living out of a suitcase or whatever he would possibly have with him.
Exactly. We've seen the term ride the rails used around. I think Kelly uses that sometimes in other writings to describe what Miller was doing. But yeah, sometimes it was just hitching a ride on a, you know, freight train, either by paying for a ticket or not. But he, you know, Miller did whatever it took to visit as many cities as he could to drive up support for a national convention. And also, I think we just heard JC, the narrator, you know, she mentioned there were three members from St. Louis who were actually proxies. Who were the, it was Sutter, Berlovitz, and Dorsey. And it doesn't mention this, but they were actually proxies for Duluth, Philadelphia, and Milwaukee, respectively. So those are the other cities that were that were represented, along with Chicago, Evansville, Indianapolis, St. Louis, and Toledo.
Next up is great-granddaughter Vicki Kelly, an environmental scientist.
The convention remained in session 1 week and prepared a constitution, ritual, and all other things that go into an organization. It was agreed that only corn cob pipes would be smoked during the convention, and it would be hard to find a jollier, more enthusiastic bunch than the one that met in a room near 28th and Franklin Avenue and organized the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. On the last day of the convention, the following officers were elected: Henry Miller, Grand President; E.C. Hartung, First Grand Vice President; F.J. Heiselman, Second Grand Vice President; T.J. Fennell, Third Grand Vice President and Grand Organizer; and J.T. Kelly, Grand Secretary Treasurer.
Wow, so there it is, 28th and Franklin.
Exactly.
So that should clear it up, right?
Mm-hmm.
That should put the Stoley's Dance Hall to bed right there.
You would think so, and it's unfortunate that this, you know, one paragraph, as you mentioned at the beginning, wasn't, you know, more widely circulated. But it certainly seems to be the case that the origin of 5221, which met at Stoley's Hall, and the origin of the IBEW, which met at, you know, 28 and Franklin, were somehow joined as one story. And we've sort of assumed the Stoley's Hall portion as the founding. But, you know, there's, as with all legends, there's some truth there. And the truth is that Henry Miller and Kelly got their start at Stoley's Hall and sort of, you know, were initiated into a union for electrical workers there. So that is certainly part of our history. But those men then, you know, then went to a boarding house to actually found the IBEW. But there it is, right? That is the key information that we needed to find the boarding house. And using this one sentence, what does he say? The corner of 28th and Franklin, in looking at the first constitution that was printed for the organization, it lists the addresses for the executive officers. And sure enough, the address given for Henry Miller was 2728 Franklin Ave. And so that is the first full instance of the exact address for that building. So we narrowed it down even further from 28th and Franklin to 2728. And in looking at Google Maps for that current address, there was one building standing, and that building is now the Henry Miller Museum. So all thanks to this one report written by J.T. Kelly, we have our home revitalized and restored.
And any idea, Curtis, what the significance was of the corn cob pipes? Is that just
I couldn't even wager a guess.
Let me ask you, are you smoking a corn cob pipe right now today
in
commemoration of the...
I'll tip my hat to them, but no smoking of corn cob pipes. But I will say, in that regard, I did have a chance to visit the Henry Miller Museum when it opened up last year at the convention, and you've done just an incredibly impressive job in recreating that boarding house. But it was an emotional time to go up to that second floor and to see a recreation of Miller's bedroom, but also of the meeting room, you know, just this small round table, and you had put 10 empty chairs around it with corn cob pipes. And it was almost like you walked into the founding and you realized, wow, there's nothing more humble, for an origin story, you know, than this. Just a small wooden table, corn cob pipes with 10 guys gathered around and just hammered out details, all in the hopes that they would create an organization that would last. And none of them knew, none of them had any guarantee that it would work, but they put the work in, and here we are 126 years later.
Pretty neat. And we have to give...
Pretty neat.
I'd be remiss if I didn't recognize the work of Dave Roth, business representative here at Local One, in gathering the historic pieces, along with Nene Harris, a St. Louis historian, who helped us set up that room as it would have been in the 1890s. And so they deserve a great deal of credit for setting that scene and using the information that you provided, the documentation that you provided, to sort of give them some insight into what that may have been like at the time. So it's a very moving spot for people when they go in there. The original floor is back down, and they didn't take all the story off of it, and they did a phenomenal job. So you're right about that. So this is kind of fun for me. This is James William Kelly III, and as he reads the next section.
This is James William Kelly III. My father is James William Kelly Jr. My grandfather is James William Kelly Sr., who is also the son of J.T. Kelly. In the first issue of The Electrical Worker appeared the following editorial. The chronicler of time had almost closed his volume on the 19th century, a century that will go down the ages as the transition period from the ancient to the modern, from the old order of things to the new. He had recorded in glowing colors the discoveries and progress of this age, how a struggling infant had grown to be a giant and given its name to the century, the age of electricity. With the introduction of this new and subtle force, harmless when handled properly, but more terrible than the thunderbolts of Jove in the hands of unskilled men, one would naturally suppose that the men who have to deal with it would be well paid for their work. But alas, the men who have carried the telegraph lines from ocean to ocean, who moved the web of telephone wires in every city and town, who erected the lights that transform night into day, who constructed the machines and instruments by which this has been accomplished, who risked their lives daily so that the communities may have light, news, easy communication, and protection, have been reduced year by year from their rightful position among skilled mechanics until today, both in wages and social standing, they are lower than any other trade, requiring as much skill and manual effort, while the trade is overrun with unskilled men, and in consequence, the danger to life and public safety is constantly increasing.
So there you go. Wow. Hats off to James William Kelly III. That's a tough section. I've read it, and I've tried to read it out loud. And
you know, it almost reads like the like they used to write in the 18th century. There's no punctuation. It's just one long sentence. With I guess there's plenty of commas, but yeah, it just goes on and on. But it's a powerful statement, right? And that really drives home the need for a union, especially for electrical workers. I mean, this is one of the most dangerous professions in the world because of the dangers of the electrical current. And yet, you know, despite how much we rely on electricity, even 125 years ago, the workers who were tasked with maintaining these lines, installing them, directing them, were highly unskilled, were seen as easily replaced, and because of that, they were faced with, you know, an industry that gave them an unlivable wage, that didn't provide proper safety. And that worked them in many cases to death. And it's this plight that Henry Miller and J.T. Kelly and others were experiencing every day that led them to finally put up a fight and say, you know, we have a voice, we have rights, we demand protections, and we're going to create an organization to give us those. So it's a great editorial, and it's very proper that it appeared in the first issue of The Electrical Worker.
Next up is the great-granddaughter of J.T. Kelly. Here's Sarah Kelly.
My name is Sarah Kelly. I am the great-granddaughter of J.T. Kelly, and I was named for his wife, the first Sarah Deppin Kelly. I'm going to read paragraph 9 because there's mention of wives in there. When the Brotherhood was organized, the average wage was $2 per day for 10 hours work, 20 cents an hour. Such a thing as homeowner was unknown, and the men were compelled by necessity to live in the poorest section of a city. Today, a very large number of our members own their homes, and a still larger number own automobiles, which enable them to live in outlying parts of the city and enjoy all the pleasures of country and city life. With this digression, I will return to my story. The convention made a bad blunder in making the per capita too low, 10 cents per month, and in agreeing to pay funeral benefits for a member and a member's wife, which handicapped the efficiency of the Brotherhood for a number of years. A bad start is difficult to correct, and it was a hard fight at succeeding conventions to raise the per capita.
So Sarah gives us some insight into some of the early financial struggles.
Mm-hmm. Sarah does really give us a picture of how desperate workers' lives were with $2 a day for 10 hours of work. But it's because of such meager amounts of income that the first executive officers decided to keep the per capita rate so low, because workers were already, I guess, you know, pinched for any disposable income. But because of that, and the agreement to pay for all funeral benefits, and you have to remember, this is one of the most dangerous industries to work in. Fatality rates were the highest of all the industries. Then because of all those expenses that we were agreeing to, the organization almost went bankrupt. And there was also a strike about a year later, or just a general economic depression, and it hurt our membership. And it was a hard first couple of years, to be sure.
Okay. Next up is Sheila Kelly Sigmund, great granddaughter of J.T. Kelly.
Hi, my name is Sheila Sigmund. My maiden name is Kelly. I'm J.T. Kelly's great-granddaughter. When the convention adjourned, Grand President Miller was authorized to go on the road organizing. He volunteered to do this, as there were no funds available. The only money the Brotherhood had was $100, loaned by the St. Louis Union. Brother Miller, after receiving a small part of this, hit the trail. As for the general office, yours truly, it was necessary to get constitutions, rituals, and all the various supplies used by an organization printed and charter and seals engraved. I borrowed money on building association stock, which I happened to have, and started the machine generating. The first stop made by Brother Miller after leaving St. Louis was Birmingham, Alabama, where the American Federation of Labor was holding its annual convention. He applied for a charter for the National Brotherhood, which was granted with jurisdiction over all electrical workers.
So there, Sheila reminds us again about J.T. Kelly using his own personal finances to fund our organization in its early years.
Correct. I mean, you have to remember, there are really no members yet to the IBEW. You know, these men just adjourned the first convention. They have people in mind, but they need applications to become a member, and there's no dues money coming in. So you've got $100 that 5221 loaned to the NBEW. This does point again to the pretty desperate financial times to the organization. But I love the story of, you know, hearing that Miller, you know, grabbed a copy of our, you know, Constitution and jumped on a train and took it down to Alabama. And there he met, you know, Samuel Gompers, the founder of the AFL, which was founded only 5 years before that, 1886, I believe. And so here's a giant of the union world in Gompers meeting with a soon-to-be giant in the, you know, first president of the IBEW, getting together and saying, "Hey, we want to join this unionism movement. Can we affiliate?" And sure enough, Gompers signed the papers, and, you know, thus was born the IBEW's jurisdiction over all electrical workers. So quite a momentous and august event. Wish I could have been there.
Next up is Peter Kelly. Now, Peter, I will let him introduce himself, and I think the members will enjoy this. Here's Peter Kelly.
This is Peter Kelly. J.T. Kelly was my father's grandfather. His name was James Timothy, and I am the owner of a mechanical contracting firm, and we're a union shop, signatory to sheet metal workers and pipe fitters. I do work regularly with union electricians, as we call them out here, wiremen. Specifically, Local 6 out of San Francisco, Local 617 out of San Mateo County, Local 332 out of Santa Clara County, and Local 595 out of Alameda County. So I have a distinct straight-up relationship with the union electricians. Henry Miller and T.J. Finnell would organize 45 local unions by the end of our inaugural year. And noting that only about one-third of the newly chartered locals would survive. The second convention met in Chicago, November 12, 1892, with 27 unions represented by delegates and several by proxy. The New York Union, number 5468, AFL, applied to the convention for a charter, and as number 3, Birmingham, had lapsed, that number was given to the New York Union. At this convention, the funeral benefit for a member and for a member's wife was doubled, but no raise was made in per capita to meet the added expense. The executive board was increased from 5 to 9 members, and the following officers were elected: Henry Miller, Grand President; J.T. Kelly, Grand Secretary Treasurer. During the second year, the number of unions was increased to 65, and the third convention, assembled in Cleveland, November 13th, with 45 unions represented by delegates. This was not a harmonious convention, and for lack of foresight and brotherly feeling, the organization received a setback which it took years to regain. The bone of contention was number 3, New York, which was represented by 5 able delegates. Number 3 claimed jurisdiction over all inside men in New York, Brooklyn, and Jersey City, and that this jurisdiction was granted to them by Grand President Miller. Numbers 31, 34, and 36 claimed they had a right to take an inside men. The convention decided against number 3. This was the start of the jurisdictional fight between wiremen and linemen. The delegates representing 31, 34, and 36 told the convention what great things they could do if given the chance, and that number 3 was only bluffing. The linemen were in majority, and those who wanted the linemen's vote voted with them. After the convention, number 3 withdrew from the Brotherhood. Numbers 31, 34, and 36 did not make good and were down and out together with several neighboring unions within a year, and number 3, which had in the meantime joined the Knights of Labor, was in control. The ranked decision of the convention caused a loss of at least 2,000 members, when 2,000 members and the per capita from 2,000 members meant so much to a young, struggling organization.
So there you go. That kind of spells out we lose Local 3.
Exactly. And this sort of... This is the beginnings of some strife and animosity that would later come to a bigger head about 10 or 12 years later. But this is really it. This culture clash between linemen and wiremen that had its start here in this scuff with Local number 3. So true. It's true. New York City is still, Local number 3 wasn't the first one that went to Birmingham. Local 3 became New York in, 1892? But then a year later at this third convention, they left. They dropped out. And so they were no longer IBW starting in 1893. We had a few more Local 3s after that. Those each went defunct. And then finally... what was it, 7 years later, in 1900, New York City comes back into the fold and is given number three again. So that is the history there. But as you can imagine, once again, our executive officers, you know, kept the per capita rates low, but increased the benefits, and that hurt the coffers of the international. And I think next year, 1894, is the big depression, and so that really had a huge negative impact on membership and finances, as we will probably hear in the next paragraph.
And Local 3 now is the largest local union in the organization, correct?
Correct. So they were important, 120 years ago. They had a lot of power then, just simply because of the numbers of electricians in the city, and that is still the case today, because New York is still, the one of the jewels of North America.
And Christopher Erickson, Brother Erickson, is the chairman of the International Executive Council, also business manager for Local 3. Do you know roughly how many members they have?
Oh, I think 30? The last count was around 30,000, give or take a few thousand. So,
and
certainly impressive.
That is very impressive. I can imagine what a union meeting would be like at Local 3. I'd like to go to one of them. Maybe I'll put that on my bucket list. Okay,
it's next. Like a mini convention, for just one meeting.
Next up is Aiden Kelly.
This is Aiden Kelly, and I am the great-great-grandson of J.T. Kelly. This convention abolished the wife funeral benefit, raised the per capita to 15 cents, and changed from annual to biannual conventions. The following officers were elected: Kieran Jansen, number 2, Grand President; J.T. Kelly, Grand Secretary Treasurer; Henry Miller would be named 3rd Vice President and Organizer during this convention. During the next 2 years, we were passing through panic and progress was slow. The number of unions on our roster had increased to 81, but several had lapsed and nearly all had lost in membership, so that the total membership was not as great as at the Cleveland Convention. The 4th Convention met in Washington, November 11, 1905, with only one delegate present from the whole Coast District from Philadelphia to Maine, E. Colvin, Number 35, Boston. There were only about 2 delegates who attended the Cleveland Convention present to see the havoc their lack of foresight and justice had caused. The Washington Convention did all it could to improve conditions, principally by a better financial system.
Okay, so we see the results of the loss of Local 3.
Mm-hmm. That coupled with all those members being lost, all that per capita being lost, having a big competitor now in New York City, meant that the financial situation was pretty dire for the IBW. And coupled with the economic depression, the employment panic, it halved our successes. Literally, we lost half our members, half our locals. It was a pretty big blow, and it could have been, probably should have been the end, for such a young organization facing these tough headwinds. But thankfully it wasn't, right? I mean, the need for an organization was so great that, those passionate members kept it going and survived to the next convention. But it was certainly tough times for the IBW. And it is, I did see that Henry Miller, was not elected president for a third term, but he did go on to become the first grand organizer for the IBW. So his time as a spokesperson for the organization wasn't done yet.
Next up is Kevin Kelly, the great-grandson of JT, and here's an interesting story about the Kelly family. Kevin would graduate with an English degree in 1974, and after attending a weekend seminar on teaching overseas, he accepted a position in Australia. And so he signed a 2-year contract, and he went over there, spent a couple of years over there in Melbourne, met his bride there, married her. They came back. She was also a teacher. They came back to the States in California, and her degree really wasn't recognized here in the States, so they went back to Australia. And basically now he's in Geelong, Victoria, Australia, where he is a teacher, along with his wife, who is also a teacher. And he has three beautiful daughters, and we're going to hear from one of them in a minute. But first, here is great-grandson Kevin Kelly.
My name is Kevin Gerard Kelly. I am J.T. Kelly's great-grandson. The panic continued during the next 2 years, with some improvement towards the latter part of 1897, which was manifest by a decided improvement in the financial affairs of the Brotherhood. And we went into the convention held in Detroit, November 14th, for the first time with a substantial balance in the Treasury instead of a deficit as heretofore. The tide was turning, but too late for the officers in charge. There was a clamor for change. New officers were elected who had only to go along with the tide, with the boom in electrical development. Founder J.T. Kelly would be replaced as Grand Secretary during the Detroit Convention. The General Office of the Brotherhood was removed from St. Louis to Rochester. No jurisdiction disputes came up at this convention. I returned to my trade, journeyman wireman, and I am still at it.
Okay, now for the record, in order to make this a little bit easier to read, and Curtis, I know you agree with me, if you go through this, it is difficult to read some of this script.
Correct.
From his original 1921 dinner program. So I pulled a portion of it out, and that portion that I pulled out was sort of the minutiae that detailed all the individual officers. And we hear in this particular section that JT is not reelected as Grand Secretary.
Yes. I mean, it was a good decision. It kind of goes on and on. It's too much detail than we really need. So it was a good decision to, you know, kind of take that out. But yeah, we do hear that, you know, JT Kelly is retired from the position, and he has been our Secretary Treasurer for 1891 to 1897. Actually, he was only Secretary Treasurer for the first year. There was no treasurer that year, 1891. And then the position was created in 1892. And so J.T. Kelly just remained the secretary up until 97. And the treasurer position lasted up until, for another 100 years, it lasted until 1997, when once again, the position of secretary and treasurer were joined under Ed Hill. And so now, just like the beginning, we have a secretary treasurer position like what Kelly was at the founding.
And one of the things that I'd like you to speak to is the fact that the international office follows the publishing office of the electrical worker.
Yes. So yeah, that was just one little line. The general office has moved from St. Louis to Rochester. And this really had its, I guess, impetus in the growing influence of the IBW, but also of the need to maintain a current president's home base. We were founded in St. Louis. All the executive officers were living in St. Louis. And so the international office was by default in St. Louis. But then I think the president, who was elected in 1897, was from Rochester, and his local was in Rochester. And so the international office, in deference to him, moved to his home base in Rochester. It made sense. He was already there. And again, we didn't have the amount of influence and finances to have a permanent headquarters somewhere. So we simply just moved offices to wherever was most convenient. And this happened a few more times. We moved to first Rochester. We moved to New York City for a few years, then Springfield, Illinois. And we didn't finally move to D.C., to our permanent home, until 1920. And that was the time when we had the influence, we had the finances available to say, you know, we need a permanent home. We can't just be jumping around the country every couple of years. So, yeah, for our first 30 years, the international office was on a rotating basis.
Okay, back again to great-great-grandson, Aidan Kelly.
The 6th convention was held in Pittsburgh, November 1899, the 7th in St. Louis in September 1909, the 8th in Salt Lake City in 1903, the 9th in Louisville, 1905. I attended all 4 as delegate from number 1. The Pittsburgh convention was harmonious, only a little kick against number 1 for charging difference in initiation fee. Thomas Wheeler, number 38, was elected president, and H.W. Sherman, secretary. The St. Louis convention had half a dozen scraps on hand at one time. Forbes against Sherman, McNulty and number 33 against Wheeler and Sherman, Wissinger against Sherman and the executive board, the whole bunch against Wheeler and Sherman, and the linemen against the wiremen. At the close, a truce was declared for 2 years, and W.A. Jackson was elected grand president and H.W. Sherman re-elected grand secretary.
Wow, that's a tough one.
Yes. But here we go again. After a few conventions of relative harmony, we've got these officers bickering again. And almost always it came down to this lineman-wireman line in the sand, where you had conflicting philosophies, conflicting priorities, where some members wanted to pull the organization this way and that, and we've had all these officers running against each other, debates on the floor, or as Kelly says, dozen scraps on hand. But this really kind of sets the tone for the next few years, and I think while a truce was declared, a peace wasn't declared. And that comes to fore in I think that the next convention, which really kind of splits everyone apart. But we'll get to that in the next section. So, but it had its beginnings here at the 1905 convention in Louisville.
Next up is Bridget Kelly, the second of 3 daughters to Kevin Kelly, eldest son of James William Kelly Jr., the son of J.T. Kelly. She's an English literature teacher in Victoria, Australia. So this will be fun. Here's one of the Kellys with an Australian accent.
Both the linemen and wiremen went to the Salt Lake Convention primed for a fight, which lasted nearly a week and ended in a compromise. F.J. McNulty was elected Grand President and H.W. Sherman re-elected Grand Secretary. The question of jurisdiction was fought all over again at the Louisville Convention. A committee on constitution and bylaws controlled by linemen met 2 weeks before the convention and prepared a constitution and jurisdiction which was forced on the inside men. Not satisfied with this, Burns, of number 17, acting as leader, put through an additional amendment that conventions be held every 4 years and a further amendment that the constitution be swallowed in one dose. These were the straws that broke the camel's back. At the end of 2 years, the time a convention should be held, some of the locals got restless, others had grievances. These and other minor causes led to the calling of a special convention, which resulted in a dual organisation for a number of years. I made a vigorous protest against changing to 4 years, as a reference to page 510 of the proceedings will show.
Okay, Curtis, so this is why we have you on the phone.
Yeah. Oh God. I don't know how much I want to go into this.
Oh, well, sure. No, I understand. Well, whatever you think.
Mm-hmm. So here you go. We've seen hints at this division that has sort of infected the organization since the beginning, and it finally has to come to a head. This is the growing pains of any new organization. A lot of labor unions had gone through this and didn't survive. We did. But this was the climax of it. So basically what happened is that after the Louisville convention in 1905, the next convention should have happened in 1907. But it didn't, right? That was 2 years later. So a lot of locals were getting, angry and filled with angst, and they wanted their concerns voiced, and they weren't. So a special convention was called in 1908, by one of the first first grand presidents, James Reed. And the first district back then was almost the entire East Coast. He was based out of Pennsylvania. And basically, he came together with many locals, many linemen locals, and put a proposition forward saying that we cannot trust our executive officers anymore, meaning President McNulty and Secretary Collins. And the delegates present at this special convention voted out the executive officers and installed James Reed as the new president of the IBEW. They thought their actions were completely legitimate, so they continued producing the Electrical Worker Journal. They actually had another convention a few years later. They had officers, they had locals. Meanwhile, McNulty is sitting not at this special convention, saying, "Well, wait, hold on, I didn't call for any of this. I'm still the president." And so he continues to collect, per capita from locals. He continues to produce his own Electrical Worker Journal. So essentially, you have two IBEWs existing simultaneously that both think they are the legitimate organization. And this goes on for 5 years, from 1908 to the early part of 1913. And so it's a really dark period for our organization. It did all end well. We're still here as one organization, so we did eventually come together. But it was not a good time for such a young union.
Okay, next up is great-great-granddaughter Tessa Kelly.
Hi, my name is Tessa Kelly. J.T. Kelly was my grandfather's grandfather. I attended the convention of the AFL at Denver in 1894. By getting acquainted with Western delegates and urging the necessity of assisting the electrical workers on the convention, and offering a premium to organizers of AFL of 50 cents per member for all members organized, unions were organized in Denver, Butte, Salt Lake City, Spokane, Tacoma, Seattle, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. My treat for 2 weeks at AFL convention and organizing cost to the Brotherhood, $36. I mention this for the benefit of present-day members, to dispel any idea that the organizers of the Brotherhood made a fortune out of. In 1895, the AFL met in New York. I reorganized four unions in New York and vicinity, and also organized the first union in Schenectady, New York, number 70, while attending this convention.
And here is the young Connor Kelly O'Neill with the next section.
Connor Kelly O'Neill, great-great-grandson. In 1896, the AFL met in Cincinnati, and I reorganized that city. I did not attend any more AFL conventions until 1901 at Scranton. I also attended conventions of the National Building Trades Council at Cincinnati in 1900 and at the Worcester in 1901. At all of these conventions, the jurisdiction and the rights of electrical workers were presented and maintained. We never received an adverse decision. I have been blamed for giving up our jurisdiction to the Theatrical Brotherhood. This was done by order of the Detroit Convention and over my protest, as the proceedings will show. The elevator jurisdiction agreement was made by my successor several years after I was out of office.
So I don't know if you have anything to say on that one or not.
Oh, no. I guess, that we're kind of backtracking in this paragraph. James Kelly is basically describing, his end of IBEW conventions and then starts to go back and say his involvement with the AFL, which certainly was important. This was just the AFL. The CIO wasn't around yet. And so this was the big, union, affiliate organization around. And then he goes into a little bit about, hey, don't blame me for losing the Theatrical Brotherhood. So maybe he was still upset about his critics out there. And he had to address it once and for all.
And finally, to close it out, Emma Keeley, the great-great-granddaughter of JT, she visited the museum and she has signed the beam in the basement, adjacent to the granddaughter of J.T. Kelly, Bernadette Kelly, who also visited. So let's hear Emma's portion.
This is Emma Keeley,
the great-great-granddaughter of J.T. Kelly. During my administration, we had several disastrous strikes. I will mention one in particular as an object lesson. In 1896, the electrical workers of Milwaukee were 100% organized. The streetcar men went on strike. They asked the electricians to help them by calling out their men working for the streetcar company. Some hotheads at a called meeting advocated and carried their point that a general strike of all electrical workers be called, and linemen, wiremen, maintenance men. In fact, every man under jurisdiction of Number 2 was called out. The strike was lost. Number 2 was wiped out, and I doubt if Milwaukee has recovered to this day what it lost by an ill-advised strike. Since the Louisville Convention, I have not been in official touch with the affairs of the Brotherhood, and will close my swan song. I hope to meet a few of the old-timers at the coming convention. Old men for council, young men for war, has been a saying since the days of Homer. We are at a critical period. There must be a readjustment. It is no disgrace to retreat if you can strengthen your position thereby. Moore's lines, "He fears his fate too much, or his deserts are small, who dare not put into the touch, and win or lose it all," do not apply to labor unions. Maintain your organization first, last, and all the time. Xenophon's army was as good at the end of a 2,000-mile retreat as when it started out. There will be some great smashing during the next year or two, and the electrical workers should not be caught in the maelstrom. J.T. Kelly.
So, Curtis, if you don't mind, mm-hmm. now that we're through that, I just wanted to talk to you specifically about the museum in D.C., which is a great place. We went there before the restoration began on the Henry Miller Museum, and you gave us a lot of insight. Mm-hmm. You gave us sort of a look behind the curtain. I joked with Frank sure. that, you know, we got sort of a peek into the inner sanctum. Some of the original ledgers of J.T. Kelly, and one in particular that had some crayon on it.
Mm-hmm. We have a wonderful facility here at the international headquarters. Like you said, we do have a museum, and we have several exhibits always present. But we do have a large archive in the back where everything is maintained at museum standards, and preservation materials are present to help out our objects. But you are correct. We have hundreds of objects dating to our first few years. And one of the most precious are these ledgers that were handwritten by our early founders, detailing the expenses, detailing our membership. I put on my white gloves, right? I remember opening this book, this ledger, and it was written by J.T. Kelly, detailing, you know, his first duties for the IBW. And yeah, I guess there was some crayon on there, and I think that was drawn on there by his granddaughter. So it does sort of show that these are working documents. Sometimes, you know, mistakes are made, sometimes they fall into the wrong hands, and a toddler might use it to doodle on. That adds some charm to it, right?
So Frank called me and he said, you know, we've got one of the Kelly family that want to see the museum. Would you meet me down there? Mm-hmm. And so we gave this woman a tour of the museum and her daughter. Mm-hmm. And she says, you know, my name is Bernadette Kelly, and I am the granddaughter of JT. And when I was a little girl, mm-hmm. I grabbed a crayon and I started coloring in my grandfather's ledger. And so she's, I don't know what old she is now, but she's an elderly woman now, and she signed the beam. Mm-hmm. And so I had to laugh because the previous week we had been at the museum and you'd shown us this, and you said, look, this was done by JT's granddaughter. And I thought we all had gotten mm-hmm. a kick out of it. So for the members out there who may come across some of the important pieces, as you know, we had a 1913 mm-hmm. convention photo that was missing from your collection mm-hmm. that is now in the museum. Is there anything specifically, and you've done a tremendous job of archiving the electrical worker, because I can tell you, and if you're a history geek, It is so great that you did that work, because I am on there all the time. It is really mm-hmm. awesome. So especially the early issues of the Electrical Worker, you're missing a few of those, correct?
We are missing a few, and it's a sore spot for me, because as a historian, I want to have all my documentation in order, and I want everything to be sequential and symmetrical. And it is a shame that we are missing a few. We're missing actually 2 whole years of electrical worker issues, and those years are 1894 and 1895. So it is a shame that we don't have them, because they're some of the earliest. And so some of the early struggles and successes that probably happened those years that would have been detailed in those issues, we don't have them to research. So yes, we do have the first year's issues, 1893, and we're missing the next subsequent years. But members, you know, if you've got them, if your local hall somehow has a copy in some old box in the attic, and you want a place to put them, please consider sending them to the international office. They will be digitized here and scanned and preserved for all members to read and peruse on the IBW website. But if you come across them, you know, don't use them for kindling. You know, please consider donating them to any historical society, but it'd be great if we could get our hands on those, because they are sort of a last missing link for our complete collection.
And for the 39th convention, you created a mini museum mm-hmm. that was absolutely spectacular. I mean, it really was beyond my expectation. When we talked mm-hmm. on the phone, you said, I'm bringing a portion of the archives with me, and we're going to set up in the exposition hall. And boy, when I walked in, I was blown away. That was really, really amazing. Now, have you had an opportunity to take that on the road since then, or do you think that's just a convention display?
Well, there is talk of recreating, you know, some of that for subsequent conventions, and so that'd be very fun to do that every 5 years. I think that's an appropriate amount of time. You know, we don't want to move these objects too much, because that will sort of, create more risk for damage and whatnot. But you are correct that it did exceed expectations. It exceeded my expectations. I was very pleased with the result. And a lot of locals expressed interest in it as well. So while we haven't done a traveling exhibit of sorts, I do assist locals, you know, over the phone and with documentation whenever they call and say, we would like to, you know, sort of recreate what we saw at the convention, you know, do a little history display at our local hall. And, you know, what advice do you have? So I do offer my services in that regard. You know, I consult with locals, you know, they tell me what objects they have or what sort of themes that they should present. And I work with them in that sense. And then just in general, the resources I have at the international office are available to any local hall looking to give some history to members. So like you mentioned before, every issue that we have of the Electrical Worker is digital. It's on the website for IBW. But what I have here at the international office are digital copies of every local's local lines, you know, the articles they send to the Electrical Worker. I can compile them into one PDF and send that over to a local, and that gives them a great snapshot of their history, because it's all of the articles they've submitted that either talk about a struggle that their local is going through or a victory and a success. And so you put those all together, and it's a great timeline of a local's history. You know, and we've got photos of the conventions. We've got photos of badges. We've got, you know, documents detailing all the officers of a local union. So if you're missing any records, please, you know, feel free to contact me at the IBW, you know, International Museum. My contact's on the website if you need a reference. And you know, we do what we can here to help preserve our history and help locals educate the members, and especially the new members coming in, any way we can to preserve that history, we will do it.
So I reached out to Curtis. I'll tell a little story about myself. I reached out to Curtis and I said, Curtis, I have this great idea. I'm going to start this member source project here at Local One, and I'm going to have our members volunteer to transcribe a local lines from your archive starting from 1893. And you responded, John, I can send you all your local lines in a PDF. I've already done it. Here you go. Hey, and I was like, okay, never mind then.
All right.
I went in Frank's office.
Project said, done.
I'm done with that already. But
it's a good service we provide here. It'll save you a lot.
That was really great. I mean, I had this big brainstorm idea. I presented it to the business manager and I reached out to you. What do you think of this? And you're like, well, how about I just email it to you? And you kept me off. So sometimes I get excited about this stuff and I sort of jump off the excitement cliff, so to speak. And you sort of bring me back and you're like, well, John, maybe you need to read this. I'm like, oh, okay, I had that wrong. But anyway.
But hey, it's what we need. We need enthusiasm about our history, right? If we don't have that, then we forget it and we take things for granted. And we start to lose those benefits that our founders strove so hard to attain. If we forget the struggles that they had to endure to get us those benefits and those, you know, livable standards, then we will see those benefits go away if we don't hold on to them, if we don't understand their importance. So it's people like you and locals out there that really care about, you know, the IBW's history that preserve what we have for future generations. So it's important work.
So let me ask you,
history never ends.
So let me ask you a question. Didn't you recently do several upgrades to your museum in DC?
We did. Yes. We have a few interactive touch screens in the museum, that display information regarding what section they're in. So, you know, we have a section on locals, one on conventions, one on all the industries of electrical work that we represent. And those touch screens were a little outdated. So we've installed new screens that have new information, that have kept up with the times, in terms of the new technologies that are available for our members to work with. We've added, you know, more objects from the most recent convention in our convention section. And we also have a middle section of the museum that's for rotating exhibit spaces, that I try to, you know, get more objects out of the archive to bring to light. And so those are always changing, but the big facelift was getting those new screens in. And we, our media department here at the International, put together about a 5-minute mini documentary about the last convention. And so that is up on one of the major display monitors that members can come in. You know, if they didn't attend, they hit play and they get a nice snapshot of what went down at the convention and kind of what the convention atmosphere is all about. Every several months, and certainly after a convention, we try to update the museum content to keep it fresh and keep it vibrant.
So I reached out to you when we were building the website for the museum, and you drafted a wonderfully written article about the importance of cherishing our history. And I won't go into the details of that, but so tell me about what your background is and how you came to be the museum curator at the IBW.
My background is history. That is where my number one passion resides. And that passion led to a bachelor's degree in classical archaeology because I wanted to be Indiana Jones. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of opportunities there, but there is plenty of opportunities for an archaeologist to work in a museum. And I really fell in love with the whole museum environment, with exhibits, with working with historical artifacts and presenting them to the people in an educational and intellectual stimulating way. So that degree led to a graduate degree in museum studies. And I attended the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. And so that's where I really studied the intricate nature of a museum, how to display exhibits, how to write exhibit panels, how to preserve artifacts appropriately. And I graduated in 2008. And that is when the International Office of the IBEW had just met with an exhibit company to install an exhibit of IBEW history at their new headquarters. They were just about putting the final details on this exhibit when they decided that the International Office needed a permanent curator or collections manager. I applied for the position and worked for 2 years under International Representative Mike Nugent, who is sort of the historian here at the International Office, learning the ins and outs of IBEW history. And so my background was not the electrical world. I wasn't an IBEW member. I just had that passion for history. And so when I came here to the IBEW and learned of the incredible, rich 126-year history of the IBEW, I couldn't help but be pulled by it, but become passionate by it. And when you become an employee of the International, you join the IBEW, right? You join a local, you pay your dues. And so I am an IBEW member, as are many people in this building. We all come from different backgrounds, photographers, journalists, media people, writers, researchers. So we don't necessarily come from the electrical world, but we're here now and we fight for it every day. And so I do what I can in terms of history to keep the IBEW alive. I've been here 9 years and, plan to be here as long
as
I can.
That's awesome. Weren't you an intern? Didn't I read that you interned at the Smithsonian?
You've done your research. Yeah. So well, as part of the museum studies program, they wanted you to get your feet wet to see what a practical museum life is like. So you had to do two internships, and I did one at the Smithsonian, the Natural History Museum, because they're the ones that have a very small but very impressive archaeological collection. And so again, my background was archaeology. I interned there to work with their artifacts, and then I interned at the Supreme Court, because funny enough, they have a curator as well too. So everyone's got a curator apparently. But those are my internships, so that I could kind of really get my hands dirty with how to preserve artifacts. But then upon graduation, found the IBEW and they needed some help from a museum professional and someone who had the skills that would serve them, and I hope I've done a good job at that responsibility.
Well, and not only are you just packed with knowledge about our organization, and not only do you understand a great deal about museum curation, but you're also just a great guy, good person, and easy to deal with.
John.
And I know during the hustle and bustle of our push for the ribbon-cutting date last year at the 39th convention, we were standing on you pretty good, and you were unflappable during that entire time, and you were right there, responsive, helping us out every step of the way, and we really appreciate it.
I mean, that opening of that museum was an important day for all of us, for the whole organization, for every member. It's very rare for an organization like ours to still have the physical building where we began, especially 125 years old, and so it was my honor to help out as much as I could, but especially for people like you and me. I mean, it's important for our entire membership, but if you have that yearning for history, it was all hands on deck during that opening that we would push aside anything else to get that off to a good start. And so it was definitely an honor to work with you and your crew at Local One, and everyone present to give us a good grand opening. And by all means it was.
So Curtis, if I can, do you have a favorite artifact, something that your favorite part of the IBW Museum? Do you have one in particular thing or something that you, maybe something that you consider the most precious piece that we have, or something, some aspect mm-hmm. of it that is your favorite?
I do have a favorite, and I think it goes to my love of the Declaration of Independence. You know, I love founding documents because it finally puts to paper what our ideals are in what you know, country you want to create or organization you want to create. And we have in our collection a Declaration of Independence of sorts for the IBW, and it's the proceedings of the very first convention, and these were on display at our last convention in St. Louis. It's 10 pages long. It's handwritten by the secretary on lined paper in beautiful, you know, cursive penmanship, but it details the hour by hour proceedings that those 10 men in 1891 performed for 1 week, from November 21st to the 28th. And it goes through, you know, votes on who would be the speaker, who would be the secretary, who would be the president, how dues were structured, what the seal would look like, you know, with the hand grabbing electrical bolts, what our preamble would be, and what those ideals that those men were going to stand for. And we have it. We have it in writing. And it's incredible to behold and to hold it in your hand and say, you know, this was the passion of 10 men to create something that they would hope would outlast them and would last for generations. And as I mentioned earlier in this podcast, you know, they had no guarantee. They were extremely humble. They were just going to cross their fingers and make it work. But this effort that they put onto paper was proof that we came together, we made something happen. Now let's go out in the world and convince others that this is a good cause. So having that founding proceedings tells me and reminds me that we all start from humble beginnings. No matter how much success we achieve later, we have to remember how humble we started. And if you have that memory in mind, then you will fight to preserve what you have, because you know how delicate it is.
Powerful stuff.
Yes, for sure. So, yeah, so holding this document in hand that was actually put to paper by the recording secretary of the convention, and that man was T.J. Finnell, one of the delegates to the convention who was elected by his colleagues to be the secretary and to record all of their going ons for 1 week. So it wasn't J.T. Kelly. He became our first secretary of the organization, but for this founding convention, T.J. Finnell was the man who put pen to paper and gave us this very precious and powerful
document. Wow, and as we've heard before, one of the most prolific early organizers, along with Henry Miller, that would help build our early structure and local unions across the country.
Exactly. I mean, they were 10 very passionate men. You know, you had to be to actually make the expense and take the time to travel to St. Louis and just hope that you came out with a successful resolution. So they were all great organizers early on in our history.
Well, Curtis, I can't thank you enough for agreeing to talk to us and fill in the blanks mm-hmm. between the Kelly family, the descendants of J.T. Kelly today. Thanks so much for calling and checking in, and I'm sure the members are going to love it. Have yourself a wonderful holiday season. If you haven't been to the IBW Museum in Washington, D.C. at our international office headquarters, then you really need to get there because it's really, really spectacular. Thanks, Curtis.
Well, thank you, John, and thanks for putting this together, and I really applaud your efforts in getting the Kelly descendants to not only agree to do something, but to actually have this introduction. This brief history written by J.T. Kelly, to have it narrated by so many members of their family. I'm sure they were thrilled to do it. And I'm thrilled that you were able to pull this off. So it was an honor to join you and to talk IBW history. It's what I do every day.
And thank you also to all the Kelly family members that agreed to participate. Not only did they participate over their Thanksgiving holiday, but they got us those audio segments in a very short amount of time, and we appreciate that a great deal. A very prolific and talented group, the Kelly family, as they are spread across the world, as we found out this past hour. So thank you to them, and thank you, Curtis. Have a great holiday season.